Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated and Fukushima irradiated island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, where the rad level is so high that most people have now adopted a part-time job as an eco light bulb, which is good for the economy, especially the mercury in their bloodstream. And my very special guest is Kevin Galilee. And like the Sea of Galilee, he's unleashing an ocean of information about Depop. Elation. Thank you very much for joining us for a full 2 hours today. It's actually quite an awesome show so far, and it's your fault.
So yeah. we were talking about Japan.
Yeah.
I was just about to divulge the first method of population control that was used on the Japanese and all the other Axis powers. But before I say what it was, I just should mention that Japan is an island nation with very limited natural resources, an already very large population, and a modern economy that demanded, you know, vast imports of foreign resources. Japan was really the ideal testing ground for aggressive fluoridation, which was the only tried and tested fertility-depressing agent known at the time. The Nazis had used it on the Jews, and the Soviets had used it on their Gulag prisoners. And it was found to be not only extremely effective both for sterilizing men and women, but also in inducing a kind of bovine state of obedience and submissiveness, which explains...
May I ask, what's the evidence that the Nazis and the Soviets used this on people? Because I've heard this before, it makes sense to me, yet I've never seen any direct evidence. And I've talked to, Dr. Paul Connett from the Fluoride Action Network about this, and he says that it's not true. But he didn't show me any documents or evidence to prove his case either.
The reason there is no evidence, because the evidence has been censored out of the public record. There have been several mentions of this during the Nuremberg trials, but they have been cut out subsequently. And nobody was allowed to speak on this issue, none of the lawyers on either side, during the Nuremberg trials.
They were planning on using it in further, and if it had come out during the Nuremberg trials and become part of the public record, then they wouldn't be able to continue this public, in inverted commas, health policy being instituted.
And not only were they planning on using this this method, but they're planning on using the people with the expertise, the only people with the expertise, and this is the very, very interesting part. Now, in Japan, The work of poisoning the Japanese with fluoride was accomplished by the Japanese themselves. And who? Well, the war criminals from Unit 731, which was a military unit within the Japanese military that had been conducting lethal human experiments on civilians since 1937.
These are the ones that took prisoners from Manchuria and China, yes, and experimented on them, eh?
Among other things. The members of this unit, which was officially known as the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department, what an adequate name for fluoridating the water, were given immunity from criminal prosecution at war's end by General MacArthur, who was the supreme commander of the Allied forces. And instead of being executed for murder and war crimes, they were put to good work on sterilizing their fellow nationals. And many of these of the scientists who belonged to the Unit 731 went on to stellar careers within the ranks of the political establishment in Japan and civil service. So the Japanese themselves poisoned their own population.
And so it's like the Japanese equivalent of Operation Paperclip to a large degree.
Yes, and it was, of course, the material was supplied by the Brits and the Americans, but it was the Japanese themselves who put fluoride in the water, God knows at what concentrations, because there was certainly not at the tender and limited concentrations of today. And this is why it works so beautifully. And in the countryside, where there were no water treatment plants, they were handing out fluoride pills along with their rations, with the food rations. As you well know, Japan was devastated after the Second World War. The population was starving, and they were fully dependent on food rations for several years.
And that's part of the reason why the Japanese tried to surrender a number of times, but weren't allowed to surrender until after the nukes were dropped, because they wanted to see what it would do.
Yes. Having unconditionally surrendered meant that the Japanese had to submit to whatever the Allied powers would institute after the war. And all the help that they received, the reconstruction effort, and the reconstruction money that Japan and Western Europe received from the United States came obviously with conditions. And one of the conditions was that they would have to accept a population control policy. However, this was not something that was declared. It was not the politicians of the day were not given a choice. This was purely a military operation, and this is why it was conducted by military forces. And this is why the Allied used military units from within the Japanese army. And this is why they needed to give those war criminals immunity from prosecution, because you wouldn't have to convince, you know, war criminals to commit to continue to commit crimes against humanity. But they had already done so.
They've got the qualifications necessary for the job.
Exactly, they had the immorality needed to do this. So, if you want to put it in a more political perspective, the Americans have used evil to good ends, if you want. So they have used those evil people within Unit 731, who were known for having murdered tens of thousands, to achieve a demographic outcome that, in the long run, you could argue, it has helped the country achieve stability, peace, and prosperity. And we'll talk about that later. For the time being,
apart from the fact that it takes currently now about three generations to pay off one residence in Japan, in the city.
Yes.
And on top of that, they have a enormous need for foreigners to come into the country, because they simply don't have enough people of youth and working age to even sustain the country.
Yes, the situation is dire indeed, but that is the price that every nation has to pay in the demographic transition. And what is this demographic transition? Well, the demographic transition is a transition from a natural population growth, which, if you were to visualize it, it looks like a pyramid. That is to say, very few old people at the top of the pyramid, and a lot of young people and children at the bottom of the pyramid. Because with every generation, in a natural population growth, the population increases. That is to say, you know, every couple has it used
2.4.
to have. Well, the total fertility rate used to be 3, 4, 5, or 6, depending on the country. Most Western country had a total fertility rate of about 4 at the end of the Second World War. That is to say that every couple in the Western world had 3 to 4 children. That means that the population would basically almost or nearly double with every generation. So the purpose of introducing, or the first objective of a population control policy, is to bring the total fertility rate, that is to say the number of children per couple, from a natural level of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, depending on the country, to what is called replacement level fertility. That is to say, 2 children or less. If a couple, a man and a woman, has only 2 children, and every man and woman, every couple in the country has only 2 children, the population will neither grow nor decrease. It will stay stable.
Yeah, but there's still accidental deaths and things of that nature. In order to maintain a population to prevent extinction, you need a minimum of 2.4.
It actually depends on how high or how low the death, the mortality rate is. So the better, the richer the country is, and the better the medical system is, and the longer people live, you need, for most Western countries, the replacement level fertility is 2.1. The poorer a nation is, the more desperate the economic conditions are, the higher the mortality is, then you'd need 2.4, 2.5, 2.6 fertility rate to compensate for the loss of life.
That's kind of ironic. That's kind of ironic considering the United States has one of the worst birth mortality rates in the world.
That did not used to be the case. This is a very interesting point you're making. At the end of the Second World War, around 1945, 1950, until about 1955, 1960, actually the United States had by far the best statistics in terms of mortality, child survival, health, and so on. But because since then they have gradually implemented more and more covert chemical and biological methods to control fertility that in turn also damage the entire body and the endocrine system, the health of the population has diminished from decade to decade, and now the United States ranks somewhere between place 37 or 50, depending on which ranking agency you're looking at.
So similar fall in education happened around the same time period as well.
Yes, and I suspect that is intentional too, because it was decided that it's not exactly helpful to have a well-educated public, that it is better to just simply teach them skills that are, you know, necessary to make this, that, or the other, so that the people are economically viable, but they cannot make political decisions on their own. They can be easily delegated, easily manipulated, and easily convinced to do what is not necessarily in their own best interest. That is why education has changed from one which was all-encompassing. It was the purpose of education in the past generation was to give people a broad view to be able to think for themselves and so on. Now it's very specific. It's just teaching people skills, you know, how to bang a nail, how to fix a pipe, how to teach mathematics, and so on. A very, very, very limited set of skills. But to go back now to the methods used. So fluoridation was the first one and the most well-known one. But I want to put things in perspective, to give people a sense of how population control has proceeded, I want to mention a variety of methods. And I have basically listed them in two categories, direct methods and indirect methods. Among direct methods, you have three possibilities, broad possibilities. One, legislation, which is what China did. China introduced the one-child policy in 1978. With Deng Xiaoping. The moment Chairman Mao died, the new leadership listened to the international community, saw the writing on the wall, the population was growing too fast, and they're going to face tremendous food shortages in the future. And in 1978, introduced the one-child policy.
A friend of mine named his cat Chairman Mao.
Pardon me?
Meow.
Chairman Mao or just Mao?
Meow.
Meow.
So, and he did institute a one kitten policy as well.
That is the most straightforward method to control population through legislation. But of course, a democratic country could not do that for the reasons that I mentioned before. The democratic process stood in the way, the doctrine of papal infallibility, and so on. China, being a one-party state, where the political leadership makes the law, sets down the law, and dictates it, and it is enforced across the country without any ifs, buts, and maybes. China was in a position to do that because of its particular political structure, being a dictatorship if you want, or a one-party state. Call it whatever you want. The second method that is among the direct methods is a coerced surgical sterilization. This is the method chosen by India, for instance, or Indonesia, and several other countries, but India being the most the primary example because of its huge population. So, coerced surgical sterilization, what that means is that both men and women are subjected to surgery to sterilize them. Women are subjected to a tubal ligation, which takes about 7 minutes, and men to vasectomies, which takes about tubal ligation takes about 30 minutes, and a vasectomy takes about seven minutes. But because men have more power in Indian society, it is the women who are sterilized, not the men, in the vast majority. So today, in India, 80% of all women of childbearing age have been surgically sterilized, usually against their will. And how does that work? Well, it works through mobile medical caravans and sterilization camps. The Indian government has done this in several steps. They tried it in 1952 by rounding out the poor. That didn't work. It almost caused a revolution. Then Indira Gandhi tried it in 1978, again by selecting only the poor, and that was an abysmal failure. But in the meantime, they had learned their lessons, and now they do it through conniving ways. That is to say, you have mobile medical caravans going across the country through the rural, to the villages, and India's population, 80% of the Indians live in villages, and many of them are not necessarily well educated, and therefore easily deceived. And when the medical caravan pulls into the village, it says, "We offer free medical care for any women who have had, you know, two children or more. Free medical care, free medicine, and so on." So the women obviously flock there because it's a fantastic opportunity to see a doctor. And they put them under, and within half an hour, they perform the operation, and they walk out of it. They don't even know that they've been sterilized. They feel, obviously, pain. They're given some antibiotics, and that's it. And this is how India has achieved an 80% sterilization, which is an unbelievable accomplishment given the size of the population. At the same time, it hasn't worked as well as legislation, and I'll discuss that later, the successes and failures of each method. So we have legislation in China. We have coarse surgical sterilization in places like India, Indonesia, and other countries. And then we have covert methods, the methods chosen by the Western world, by freely elected democratic governments who could not go the Chinese way or the Indian way. So the Western nations have...
Well, hold on. Let's stop it there, and we'll continue to talk about the Western covert sterilization techniques after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Kevin Galilee is my guest. You are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone. Our needs are now different. The world we knew is gone.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show where the music just never stops, on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Kevin Galilee is my very special guest. Now, let's talk about Western depopulation, covert Western depopulation. And it's interesting, as we're running through this, to see the different methodologies that the elite use to depopulate the First World, the Second World, and the Third World, isn't it? They've got all different methodologies. Are you uneducated? Well, we're going to do this to you. Are you slightly educated and slightly sophisticated? Well, we're going to do that to you. Are you really educated and sophisticated? Well, we're going to do this to you and not tell you about it.
The different methodology, Vinny, was dictated by the various levels of infrastructure. For instance, you know, you cannot possibly fluoridate the water if you don't have water treatment plants. And most of the developing world does not have that. Certainly Africa doesn't, where most people drink out of rivers, wells, and puddles. So let's now list the covert methods that, for the most part, have been employed in a developing world. We have two categories there, chemical methods and biological methods. Among the chemical methods, I've already mentioned fluoridation. However, we have to distinguish here because fluoridation has been used in various ways. Either they have fluoridated the water, the salt, or the milk, or fluoridation has been done through the dental programs directly in the mouth. Now, let's take water fluoridation. Most of the water fluoridation was done by fluoridating the tap water. But when you fluoridate the tap water, you can only reach the population in the cities. You cannot reach population in towns with less than 10,000 people because it is not economically viable to have a water treatment plant. So since the population is easier controlled, easier poison, if you want, into infertility in the cities, the fluoridation agenda has gone hand in hand with urbanization. This is why now we have in the Western world rates of urbanization upwards of 80%, in most countries 90%. So it doesn't work in cities with less than 10,000 people. So what do you do? How do you fluoridate? How do you limit the fertility of people in the Western world who live in the countryside? Well, they have done it either through school programs in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, where they had mouth-washing, mouth-rinsing programs, and children had to do it in the school every morning. They have done it through a direct distribution of fluoride pills. That worked until about the 1970s. And now it has been taken over by direct applications in the mouth with fluoride veneers, which is applied by your dentist. So if you live in the countryside, chances are that it is your dentist who is sterilizing you and not the water, because the water you drink is not fluoridated. Another loophole that was to close this discrepancy between the cities and the countryside, there was also a movement to switch bottling from glass bottles to plastic bottles. And I will talk to that about that later. But initially, the water was fluoridated. The mineral water or bottled water was fluoridated in rich Western nations that already have a tradition of drinking bottled water rather than tap water. So, for instance, in most of Western Europe, especially in countries like Italy, where bottled water consumption covers 80% of the population, it made no sense to fluoridate the tap water starting with the 1980s and onwards. It made a lot more sense to fluoridate the bottled water. And this is what they did. They fluoridated only the bottled water.
What's interesting is that on the European drinking water labels, they actually have the fluoride listed on there, whereas in the rest of the Western world, they do not put the fluoride on the label.
Yeah, they have it listed now, but they didn't have it listed in the 70s and 80s when it counted the most. The reason they list it now is because they don't use water fluoridation anymore. They switch to either salt fluoridation or other methods, which I'll discuss. But about 50% of Western Europe uses salt fluoridation. Countries that were formerly water fluoridated, like Holland, France, Germany, and so on, are now using salt fluoridation. So we have water fluoridation through either bottled water or tap water, depending on the culture, depending on the country and level of development. Then you have salt fluoridation. Salt fluoridation was developed in Switzerland initially, and starting in the 1970s, it has been applied throughout the Western Hemisphere, that is to say throughout Central and Latin America and Mexico. Today, every country in the Western Hemisphere is using salt fluoridation. Why is salt fluoridation preferable for countries that are poor? Because it's not the government that pays for the poison or the cities. It is the consumer. When you go and buy your salt at the grocery store, you are buying your fluoride along with it. And because the salt is fluoridated, and this is how fluoridation is done in these countries, the consumers are not given a choice between fluoridated and non-fluoridated salt. All salt is fluoridated throughout the Western Hemisphere, with the exceptions of some countries that are using water fluoridation as well as fluoridation through dental programs, such as Argentina, Brazil as well, and other a few other countries. So you fluoridate the salt, the water, or the milk. Milk fluoridation is chosen by a very few countries. Why? Because it's probably the most immoral, as it targets only the youngest. So, milk fluoridation is used widely in Thailand. It was used in Bulgaria and Macedonia, in certain areas of China, about 2,000 schools, for instance. And I suspect that this is done partially in areas that are populated by ethnicities rather than by Han Chinese. But milk fluoridation is immoral because it is distributed through three school milk programs. So that is to say, the government doesn't give anybody anything for free. So when the government comes up with a program saying we're going to distribute milk for free and we're going to subsidize it, as they do in Thailand, where every child gets 5 baht per day, that baht is their currency, to buy their poisoned milk, you know that something is fishy. So Thailand...
New Zealand just started a school milk program a month or two ago, like restarted it kind of thing. Would you say, I mean, without looking at the evidence, would you speculate that that's part of the agenda here to fluoridate New Zealand children?
Canada has started too. And why should we be very weary? Because a few years ago, the World Health Organization has declared fluoride as a vital nutrient. Therefore, it can be added to food and be counted as a nutrient and doesn't even have to be listed. In other words, they're doing us a favor by enriching our milk and our food with vital nutrients. Of course, fluoride is anything but a vital nutrient. Nevertheless, it now has acquired this classification thanks to the good work of the World Health Organization. So you cannot trust anything.
It's not a vital nutrient, it's a vile contaminant.
It is one of the most poisonous, most toxic substances on Earth. You know, a spoonful will kill you. Everybody knows that. Anyway, let's go back to the list. So you have water fluoridation, you have salt fluoridation, you have milk fluoridation in a select few countries. Then you have BPA plastics. People have heard of bisphenol A, perhaps most commonly known as BPA. That is to say, plastic bottles. And why was this method devised? Because in the 1980s, people started mistrusting the water supply and the tap water, and they started buying more and more bottled water, a trend that began in Europe and spread to North America. When the government realized that people were no longer drinking their poisoned tap water, they're now drinking bottled water, they had to close that loophole. But all the water and all the beverages up until 1980 were coming in glass, not plastic. Everything was glass, bottled in glass. Well, they switched to plastic, which is now filling our landfills and makes absolutely no environmental sense, because they needed to deliver poison to the fertility depressing agents that people now were escaping by not drinking tap water anymore. So they started bottling everything in BPA plastics. BPA is an endocrine disruptor and lowers fertility and has the exact same effect as fluoride in this respect. Mm. It attacks the endocrine system and lowers fertility, and of course, as a side effect, does all kinds of other damage.
Not only in plastic bottles have they inserted this BPA, but also I've been led to believe that all major printer companies as well, so it's in every bit of ink. So whenever you get a receipt from buying your plastic water bottle, as soon as you touch the ink on it, you get the effect too.
Yes, but you don't eat that. However, or drink that. The BPA is not only the plastic bottling, it is also the epoxy resin that is used to line metal cans. So everything you buy, whether it's canned beans or canned mushrooms, it comes in cans that have been lined with epoxy resin made out of BPA. There's a very recent study done by Harvard University, which has shown that if you eat canned soup for a couple of weeks, your BPA level in the body rises from 0 to 1,500%. So you have 1,500% more BPA in your body than you would otherwise. And this causes havoc with your fertility and with your endocrine system. Now, it's very interesting because most people who eat out of cans are the poor. It's poor people who don't have the money to buy, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables, and they eat canned stuff instead. And of course, in so doing, they are receiving endocrine disruptors, and their fertility is attacked from multiple directions. And of course, this depopulation policy has a eugenic side to it, because they're trying, first of all, to limit the numbers at the bottom, and less so for people of higher socioeconomic status. And the people now at the bottom of the economic rank are receiving endocrine disruptors from every direction, from their bottled water, bottled beverages, from their canned soups and canned vegetables, and even from the water they drink at the tap, if they happen to live in a city that's bigger than 10,000. So you have fluoride, you have BPA plastics, and now the latest one, which started in 1995, is aerosol aluminum spraying. Everybody knows that as the phenomenon of chemtrails. The reason they started spraying aluminum in 1995 is because in 1994, a brilliant scientist in the United States discovered that aluminum combined with fluoride is far more damaging to the human body than half the quantity of fluoride alone.
Yeah, and also fluoridation is supposed to be around one part per million, and what I discovered is that in order to contaminate drinking water to the point where it's not fit for human consumption with aluminium is one part per million. So if you spray even one chemtrail over a populated area and the water catchments and everything like that, you've contaminated the entire water supply for the whole city.
Exactly. And this is why they spray usually over large aquifers. Say, for instance, in California, they're spraying over Mount Shasta a lot, because Mount Shasta in California is...
meltwater.
It's a very high, very tall mountain with eternal snow at the top, and it feeds every river and creek for... 300 miles radius.
They found that there was a 30,000 parts per million, and just in the meltwater, I think on the top of Mount Shasta, didn't they? Something insanely high.
Yes, and the reason they do that to that degree around Mount Shasta is because it is also a refuge of environmentally sensitive people, organic growers, hippies, and so on. Mount Shasta, as you know, is the hippie mecca of the United States. So they don't want these people to escape the poisoning methods that everybody else is subjected to. So they're trying to shut down their grow operations, their organic farms, and they do this through aluminum. Why? Because aluminum sprayed from the top, combined with barium and some other toxic, noxious stuff, kills the plants, the soil. The soil can no longer be used for agriculture. And many of these people have found that they had to shut down their farms and they had to move because they could no longer grow anything in the soil.
There's no defense against a methodology like this. I mean, what are you going to do? Buy a surface-to-air missile?
Yeah. So you see that their methods dovetail. That is to say, aluminum spraying is not only used to increase the toxicity of fluoride in the body, but it is also used to remove people from the land and to shut down organic growers. And because they once they shut down the organic growers and that land can be made available to agro businesses, large agro businesses that have developed aluminum-resistant seeds.
So now, I'm sorry, Kevin, we've been cut off by the break again. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thefinneyeastwoodshow.com. Don't you go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about depopulation on American Freedom Radio. And my very special guest is Stephen Gallilette. I've forgotten throughout the broadcast because... Kevin, sorry. I'm bad. I'm so terrible with names. Kevin Gallilee is my guest, and I have forgotten to ask him for a website so that if you, the listener, are interested in his work and the discussion that we've been having thus far today, you can actually go and visit him. I know that you're on Facebook, but have you got a website?
I used to have several, but I was shut down. As you well know, I've been imprisoned 6 times over the past 3 years. So now I use a proxy website. I use Academia, who is a very reputable website for academics. And you can find all my publications free of cost. I use ScriptD for those people who want to support me financially by buying my books, you know, for $5, which is the price they're being offered at. So ScriptD, Academia, and also LinkedIn. I have a very prominent account on LinkedIn where I post just about everything.
If you could please, after the show, like right after the show, just copy-paste those things into the Skype chat, and I'll include them in the archive so that people can go through.
Yes.
All right. So, final segment here. We only have a few minutes left, and I want you to wrap up your case as it stands. I don't know where you're going to go with this, but I just want to follow. Please go ahead.
I will cut it short. I was talking about chemical methods in detail. Just want to mention that a couple of biological methods. The method of choice now that is going to slowly replace everything else is GMOs. GMOs work beautifully. Why? Now, there's too much resistance to fluoridation. People are getting smarter, and many cities are voting against it. Fluoridation is not applicable to the developing world, as I said, either. So it doesn't work for the countries where the population is growing fastest. So GMOs were developed specifically for this. And this is why now 90% of the corn crops, for instance, throughout the Americas are GMOs. They're doing the same to cotton, rice, you name it. All of the African staple crops, cassava, bananas, sweet potato, are all being turned by hook or by crook into GMO crops. Everybody knows the story of how Monsanto and several other European and North American giants are buying up all of the heirloom seed companies, and they're shutting down people's ability to choose between regular heirloom seeds and GMO seeds. So now, whether you like it or not, you're going to be planting your next crop with GMO seeds. That is the method of choice for this century to control population. Of course, population can be tackled two ways, either by controlling fertility, that is to say, by limiting the number of people born into the world, or by increasing morbidity and mortality, that is to say, by increasing the number of people who die, who leave this world. In the developing world, in countries that have not cooperated willingly with the global depopulation policy, the latter method has been used. That is to say, they've increased morbidity and mortality. And HIV/AIDS was specifically developed for this reason and for sub-Saharan Africa. And we know exactly what kind of havoc it has wreaked there over the past 30 years.
Well, part of the reason that AIDS has been so prolific in Africa is because you're 50 times more likely for it to actually bond with your blood and infect you if you're black.
Exactly. It was developed so it targets specific genetic codes, and the code of black people was the target population, and it was the HIV AIDS was delivered to the population through a smallpox vaccine administered by the World Health Organization until 1980. That's when it was introduced into the population of Africa. Some in Brazil and also in Haiti. Those are the three countries that that were targeted. And now, since we don't have too much time to deal with further methodology, I just want to mention the different phases of the depopulation policy. What are the intentions, that is to say? Well, phase one was the objective of phase one was to bring down the total fertility rate of every country to replacement level. That is to say, 2 children per woman or less. And this has been basically accomplished with a few exceptions, mainly in Africa, a couple of countries in the Middle East, a few countries in the Far East. But by and large, the entire world now has reached replacement level fertility. And that target was set for the year 2000. It was supposed to be done by then. They more or less achieved it. Now, phase two of the depopulation policy, the objective of phase two is to ensure that the global population does not exceed 9 billion and that it peaks by 2040 or at the latest by 2050. This is why over the next 3 decades we're going to see an incremental growth in the number of fertility-depressing methods and also the intensity with which we're being subjected to them. Not in the Western world, because we have already reached our demographic transition or accomplished the demographic transition since we have been subjected to poisoning for 6 decades now. But in the developing world, they're going to be at the receiving end from now on. So phase two, the population must peak at 9 billion. Come hell or high water, it cannot go above 9 billion because it can, we simply do not have the food to even remotely feed 9 billion people. And this is going to cause way too many disruptions if it's allowed, the population is allowed to grow beyond that. Phase 3, from 2040 or 2050 onward, is to ensure a steady population decrease. So once every country has reached replacement level TFR, the population has peaked by 2050, and every country's population will start slowly decreasing, and the decrease is going to be gradual, and it's going to be controlled, and it's going to, how far it goes, how fast, depends on the country's ability to support its population, on the economic conditions, and the wealth of the country, and so on. But these are the three phases of the depopulation policy. And what I must say, you know, now to dispel all these claims that, you know, that the depopulation policy is malevolent. Yes. The methodology is definitely malevolent. It is evil, and we have seen how evil has taken advantage of our best qualities in the Western society. It has taken advantage of our democratic process and of our Christianity, our, you know, moral Christian values, but it is not malevolent. Why? If they had done absolutely nothing in 1945, if they had not started limiting population, by now the entire world would be burning. We would have twice as many Westerners, and twice as many Westerners who already consume 50% of the world's resources would mean that Westerners alone would have displaced every other country and a nation and people on this earth. We would have needed all of Africa's resources, all of Central America, all of the Americas' resources, just to feed to satisfy the needs of the Western population. If they hadn't introduced population control methods in the developing world, in Africa and in the Americas and in Asia, the population would have been so much higher now. We would have had 2 billion extra people on this earth. 2 billion more people than we have now. Today we have 7 billion. We would have had 9 billion. Not only would we have had 9 billion, we would not even have started the process, the difficult process of going through the demographic transition. And if they would have waited until today, it would have been too late. Why? Because demographic outcomes or goals take generations to accomplish. Just to bring down the total fertility rate in the Western world has taken 2, if not 3 generations. Imagine how much more difficult it is going to be, and that was for the developing world, how much more difficult it will be to accomplish this in the developing world. So if they had done nothing, all of us would have been far worse. The entire world would have been burning by now. It would have been a nuclear war by now, fighting over the meager resources left. We would have had
Because at the same time as reducing the population, they've also made lengths and strides of reducing the intelligence of said population.
Yeah.
Maybe if people weren't so stupid and dumbed down, they would have seen the scumbaggery, which is actually destroying all the resources and contaminating the environment, and gotten rid of it, theoretically.
The damage that has been done to the genetic and intellectual endowment of humanity was not intentional. It is the unintentional side effect of long-term chronic poisoning. Just think about it. Even if you took medicine for whatever ailment you have, you still have side effects. There's no such thing as medicine without side effects. Imagine what poison would do. Nobody could even dream of chronically poisoning the population for decades, for over multiple generations, without expecting severe damage done. However, it was not known. And once they had committed themselves to those desperate methods of population control, these covert chemical methods, because they had no other choice, because they could not legislate it, there was no going back. Why? In order to change tack, to change from covert methods to overt methods, that is, from covert poisoning to overt legislation, you have to tell people what you have done until now to control the population. Otherwise, people will say, whoa, we're doing just fine now. Look, population is decreasing, total fertility is decreasing, nobody has more than two kids. They would say, you know,
everybody's getting cancer, half the people are sterile.
the reason the population has decreased is because they've had the foot on the population brake for six decades. Yes.
Well, we've only got about 30 seconds left on the broadcast. Final words.
Final words. If they had done nothing, we would all be much worse off. But because they have done it for so long, the damage done to us, to the genetic and intellectual endowment, is so great that this methodology cannot continue. If it continues, we'd all be too stupid to function.
Indeed. So despite the fact that we're in a better place, we're also in a worse place as well. It's a catch-22. Thank you very much, Kevin Galilee.